If Psalm 8 is a book, and if we were to judge the content of the book by its covers, then Psalm 8 is all about God's majesty. The poet begins and ends with the declaration, "Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." When was the last time you used the word majesty or majestic in a sentence, chatting with a friend over coffee and donuts? Reading the psalm this time around, the word majestic feels a bit remote to me, like it's slipping into the fringe of my everyday vocabulary. Except maybe for this past week, as the Queen is getting more media time for her platinum jubilee, that's 70 years on the throne. She is, of course, Her Majesty the Queen, because we still refer to royalty as majesties. But really, we don't think of kings and queens as gods like people used to. And there are less and less kings and queens in the world, and even though Elizabeth, certainly at 96 years old, still carries herself with amazing poise and vigor, these days she seems to project more graceful humanity and less of that regal majesty. I can remember when I was younger, the couple of songs we used to sing in church quite a bit that has the word majesty or majestic in it. There's that one by Jack Hayford, "Majesty, worship His Majesty unto Jesus, be all glory, honor, glory, and praise." And there's that one by Michael W. Smith that is actually based on Psalm 8, "Oh Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name." But both these songs were written in 1981, and I can't remember the last time one of them came into my head in the shower or us singing them on a Sunday. In the current top 100 songs sung in church, there's one song in the top 10, written a couple of years ago with the word majesty in the chorus. It's called "King of Kings" by Jason Ingram. "Praise the Father, praise the Son, praise the Spirit, three in one, God of glory, majesty, praise forever to the King of Kings." I looked it up on YouTube. Despite the lyrics, the tune doesn't sound like an anthem you would play before royalty. Not like how "The King is Coming" makes your hair stand up, if you know the one. But that's just me. It seems most of the songs we sing in church these days prefer to talk about God's mercy and faithfulness. One says God's name is beautiful, wonderful, powerful. God is great and holy, which of course are all different shades of God's majesty. It's just that we're using some of the words that describe God and our experience of Him. The dictionary says majesty is regal, lofty, imposing character, grandeur, supreme greatness, or authority. God's majesty is what gives us that feeling of awe, that tingle in our spine when we experience Him. And it's why on this first Sunday after Pentecost, we remember Jesus sending God the Spirit to us when He returned to the Father. It's the Spirit who enables and empowers us to hear and sense and respond to God. And of course, one palpable way the Spirit helps us brush up against God's majesty is in nature. As Paul says in Romans 1:20, that God has embedded His invisible qualities into His creation. That nature bears the signature and majesty of the Creator. In fact, isn't that where we might still use the word majestic? The majestic giant cedars in Tofino. The majesty of the Rocky Mountains. Remember a few years ago, there was that horrible plane crash into the Indian Ocean between Malaysia and Australia. They looked for that wreckage for 3 years and could not find it, despite all our cutting-edge technology. Because the oceans are vast and deep and powerful. They swallow whole tankers and planes. The ocean is majestic, just like the Creator who in Genesis is said to gather up the waters, put boundaries around it to contain it so there would be dry land for us, air-breathing creatures, to live and thrive. In Jesus' time, it was so scary to go out to sea in a boat. That water was the metaphor for hell. When Jonah jumped into the sea, he would rather go to hell than to go to Nineveh to carry out his mission. The ocean is majestic, downright intimidating. And of course, there's the other thing that is majestic, the thing that makes the hair at the back of my neck stand up always without fail. It's the night sky, which is where the psalmist points to. You have set your glory in the heavens, he says. The heaven that is to me what endless infinity looks like when I stare into it. The blackness that goes on forever and forever and ever. If there's a wall at the end of the universe, we can't see it from here. Have you seen those pictures from the Hubble telescope? It records three kinds of light and a computer puts them together into pictures. And they're glorious. It's the first time we're capturing light from stars as old as creation itself. Some of what we see at night is light that left that star 13 billion years ago. The light has been traveling for all that time, and it's just arriving into our sky. It's been such a long trip. The star where the light came from might not even exist anymore. The NASA probe Voyager 1 is the furthest thing we have in space. It was launched 45 years ago, and 10 years ago it flew past Pluto's orbit. But it will take at least another 14,000 years before it will reach the end of the solar system. And already it is so far away that scientists is having trouble understanding the data it is sending back. That as far as I can tell, it is seeing things that we have never seen before, and we don't know how to make sense of it. Space is vast and majestic like the Creator. And while the psalmist has far less idea than we do of the vastness of space, what he observes, what awes him, the majesty that makes his spine tingle, is God's attention to detail. In verse 3, he imagines God's finger precisely dotting the location of each star and tracing out their orbits. And accidentally or on purpose, his imagination adds a new spin to the creation story in Genesis. In Genesis 1, we have another poet imagining God speaking things into being. So the Hebrew word translated create in Genesis 1 goes something like this. God thinks of a thing. It's a thing that has never existed before. That thing takes shape in God's mind. And then God says to himself, what am I going to call this thing? And then it comes to him, Canada Goose. And the moment he says Canada Goose, the first goose appears in the world. But then in Genesis 2, the poet tells the creation story again. But when he got to the bit where God creates the first humans, instead of create, he uses the word form or fashion. That when God made Adam, God got the palms of his hands dirty, the way a potter cups his hand on a lump of clay to shape it into a vase. That humans came into existence in a far more intimate and personal way than everything else in creation. And when God cupped his hand around us to shape us, some of God's majesty, his image, his essence is transferred onto us. Which then provokes the question from the psalmist, why? Why us? Why bother with us? Why do we matter to you so much? What do you see in us that maybe I'm not seeing in myself? Verse 4 says, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. Verse 4 is the physical geographic center of the psalm. So it turns out the psalm that begins and ends as a meditation on the majesty of God, really in the middle, the psalmist is really marveling at the value and worth of human beings in the heart and mind of the majestic God. Why is it that the majestic God endows us with his majesty, makes us princes and princesses as his children, and then invests his time and energy to love and care for us? Why in the ordered universe, where God as creator occupies the position of supreme being, would he place human beings into a place of honor below the heavens but above all the other created things as top banana, the big cheeses, a place of special attention and favor and privilege and also responsibility and accountability? So Psalm 8 is a bit cheeky. The poet starts and ends with God's majesty, and then in the heart of the poem, it's really about how great humans are, how great God made us. It's kind of like me complimenting you on what a good person you are, and then to proceed to brag about what good taste I have in choosing my friends. So how majestic is God that he would make us so great, treat us so well? Now, verse 2 is kind of difficult. Nobody seems to have completely figured out what the poet is getting at with the Hebrew word salad there. In Hebrew, verse 2 starts with the phrase, from the mouth of children a nursing baby, that is followed by, you have established strength to silence your enemies. And somewhere in there, there's a because, and there's the word avenger. So the NIV goes with, through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avengers. Is that weird to you? What does that even mean? It's hard to imagine God having an army of energizer babies. So that can't be right. The message has this. Nursing infants gurgle choruses about you. Toddler shout the songs. Shout the songs that drown out enemy talk and silence atheist babble. That's quite a profound idea. That there's something very amazing and hopeful and powerful in the birth of a baby. The new life in them that, like the majesty of nature, testifies to a creator. How intricately are human beings made, that magnificent machines we all are. That when we look at how our bodies work, we would marvel and be in awe of the one who made us. And maybe the poet is saying that a baby is God's tacit rebuttal to people who think God doesn't exist, or that he's mean, or that God has given up on the world. For a long time, scientists have wondered how genetic information is transmitted in living things. In 1953, two oddball scientists, Watson and Crick, in a back room in Cambridge, stumbled onto the structure and makeup of our genes and won the Nobel Prize. And since then, this is what scientists have figured out. So in the way English words are made up of specific combination of 26 letters, our genes have an alphabet of 4 letters, 4 genetic molecules with a name that start with the letters T, C, G, and U. That's why when we see DNA mapped out on paper, it's a long chain of these 4 letters. And each of us carry a gene that is basically a word 3 billion letters long, formed by the specific order and repetition of these 4 letters. The genetic word we each carry with 3 billion letters is the precise recipe for each of us, instead of gibberish. Like the specific order of D-O-G is a pet, change the order and you get G-O-D, God, whereas the other orders of the 3 letters are gibberish. So as we sit and live and breathe, our individual, precise, coherent recipe, word, is constantly being copied and recopied exactly. So our bodies know exactly how to make all the new cells to replace old and worn out ones. And so we don't accidentally wake up one day and see that we have grown a horn on our forehead overnight, or a toenail on our nose. And despite creation being broken and doesn't work perfectly to God's original design and vision, we still work pretty well. So when a couple decides to make a baby, the recipe for the dad and the recipe for the mom are mixed and combined to make a new, unique recipe for a new human person, never before seen in creation. And it almost always works perfectly. So we don't hear people say, oh, I hope we get a baby this time and not like last time when we got a goldfish or that tub of protein soup. Every time when we set out to make a baby, almost always we make a baby that works like a baby. But our unique genetic word is more than just a recipe. It also carries our whole story as a person with a history beyond our conscious memory. Your unique DNA tells the story of who your people are, your ancestors, where they have been, their experiences, why you have dark skin or blonde hair, can't eat dairy, or have natural immunity to certain viruses, and who knows what other surprises. So these days, for around $100, you can spit into a tube and see what your genetic story says about where your tribe has been, what they have survived, and who are the kinspeople who contributed bits of the recipe to make you who you are. My DNA story is why, even though my parents' families are both completely Chinese, when I was a baby, when my nanny took me out for a walk, strangers thought I had foreign parents. Well, I recently got an update from Ancestry, and the latest surprise is that one of my parents, maybe four or five generations back by my math, had a Korean ancestor. So my mom and I have been theorizing that is probably her side of the family, and it's probably through her mother. How neat is that? That there's an exotic Korean sidebar to my story, that as much as 6% of me is Korean, when I have never even been to Korea. How awesome is us, the human machine that we are, the information that we hold in our genes that is a recipe for us, but also an organic journal of our story and history, of the people who came before but left their genetic mark in us and contributed to every detail of us. Now, suppose the next time you go out hiking and in the middle of the trail up in North Vancouver, you see a book in the dirt. You pick up the book, open the title page, and read the words there, which either tells you what the book is about or entices you to read more to find out. You see the name of the person who wrote it, and if you're a geek like me, you might even look at who published it and when. Now, as you flip through the book, would your first thought be, oh wow, the organic material in the forest mingled together, became paper and ink, and coalesced together and formed these words, which are not gibberish but coherent sentences, that tells a story or explains something or expresses a point of view? Or would it be more likely that actually someone had an idea, then used the alphabets in our language and purposefully ordered the letters into language to write down thoughts in coherent words and sentences, and then a physical process produced that book? Did this book you find in the forest just became itself accidentally, or does the book have an author? So someone says, when we map our genome and discover the language of genetic information, we answer the question scientists have been asking about how genetic information is passed on. But in answering that question, we raised a new question, which is, who made up this code? Who invented the genetic alphabets? And who built the machine that is us to read the code and follow the instructions? That when we consider the unique genetic word we all carry, that is the recipe of us and our story, isn't it reasonable to ask who made up the language of our genes? And who wrote that word that became us? Who makes a new genetic word into flesh every time a baby is born? The famous atheist Richard Dawkins says he's still not convinced there's a God. But if he were ever to change his mind about the existence of God, it would be because of what scientists are learning about the human DNA. It is remarkable when you consider that the poet who penned Psalm 8 lived in a time when the prevailing notion of how the world came to be was that there was a great war among the Babylonian gods, and when the dust settled, human beings were made of the remains of dragon guts, the loser of the battle. The winners took their seats on thrones in the heavens, and humans were made to serve the gods as their slaves. Somehow, out of that world, a person encountered the living God and wrote Psalm 8 as an emphatic rebuttal to that inhuman view of human beings. The poet rejects the hot-tempered, power-hungry, enslaving gods and instead invites worship to a creator who stands before the night sky like Michelangelo, wearing a painter's smock before a blank canvas. He dips his finger in fluorescent paint to dot the stars and draw their orbits. The psalmist insists God is majestic, but so are we, as masterpieces of God. We're not slaves, but the children of God who carry God's majestic image and essence in our souls because he crafted us. And this is the majesty heard loudly, resoundingly when a baby is born and cries out. Today we live in a time when a lot of people believe we came into being through a series of cosmic accidents. That nature flipped the coin 3 billion times, and every time it came up heads. So our genetic word became a coherent recipe for the first human, and we were so lucky because one flip of tails would have turned the recipe into gibberish. Could we have really happened accidentally the way the organic material in a forest might accidentally become a book? What we know now about our genes begs us to ask the question, who authored us? Who designed us? And the psalmist invites us to be awed by us, and then to realize every cell in us bears the signature of our Creator. The same signature in the night sky, the same in the Tofino rainforest, and the view of vast Pacific Ocean from Ucluelet. The same signature in the Rocky Mountains and the Grand Canyon. So why does God bother with us? Because we are masterpieces of creation, handcrafted by the Creator. And more than science projects, God made us his princes and princesses in the world to love and care for his creation and each other. So the next time you pass by a mirror, stop and linger a bit. Take a good look at what you see and imagine the 3 billion letters long word that is the recipe of you that became flesh. And it's the organic record of your story as a person, descended from many, many generations of persons. And then think about the moment when God thought up those eyes, that nose, that chin, the way the hair curls up, or the way it did when you used to have hair in the early chapters of your story. And then think about that majestic finger going to work, tapping out that code one letter at a time until the 3 billion slots are filled up. And then you came to be. And God, with a glint in his eye and a purr of satisfaction, takes a sip of his beverage and says, "Boy, that's a good one. Well done, me." Have a conversation with God and then Malcolm Guite. Before the splendor of the resurrection dawns and transforms the world, I watch the lights of heaven, each a glory in their station, harbingers of heaven, keeping nights a watch with us. The moving moon and stars, his handiwork in which he still delights. And I will listen too. Open my ears to every creature that still speaks his name, from babes and sucklings to those crowned with years, for wisdom laughs and lives in both. The flame of love is kindled round the world, in old and young. I'll seek him too beyond the tame familiar world, out in the wide and wild, as much in the steep seas and mountain heights as in the startling wisdom of a child. Amen.